This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. What political shifts will 2019 bring? The new Congress is the most diverse in U.S. history, and the federal government is divided. Democrats have taken control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Republicans are still in power in the Senate. What changes will we see with a split federal government? Will Democrats be able to capitalize on their new power? A panel of political experts are here to answer these questions and more as we look ahead to 2019. Deandra Rose is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson College. Kerry Haney, professor of political science and African American studies at Duke. And Michael Bitzer, professor of political politics and history at Catawba College. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you back.
Thanks so much for having us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Happy New Year, Frank. Happy to be here.
Happy New Year to all of you. We had you on just before the year ended to take a look back, and now we're looking forward. Susan, let me ask you first, what are you looking for as we enter now 2019 with a divided government in Washington?
Well, I think I'm not looking for any bipartisanship. I think I'm expecting a continuation, a trend in polarization. And to say that really does even simplify what's going on. I think it's kind of calcified.
Yeah, it's
calcified.
Gotten really, really hard.
And I think that what comes to mind for me is the visual that I have and the verbal of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, and when he said, I believe I'm quoting, that the hearings were a calculated and orchestrated political hit. And I think we're going to see more of that kind of rhetoric and framing.
All right, Kerry, what are you paying attention to?
I'm paying attention to the number of women who've been elected to Congress, the Congress that started up yesterday, over 100 women in Congress, what that may mean for the politics of the country looking forward to 2020. This is a major shift, and it's mostly on the Democratic Party side, where I think it's the same number of women in the Republican caucus since for the last 30 years, where the women on the Democratic side have grown exponentially. So watching how the gender dynamic plays out in 2020 and leading up to 2020. And I think, and to Susan's point about the polarization, I think there's a chance that we will see some action. It depends on what the Mueller investigation turns up. And also keep in mind, we have an election coming up in 2 years. There's some Republicans who will have to position themselves in advance of that election to appear to get something done, and we may see something happen in Congress for that reason.
Deandra, what about you? What are you looking at this year?
You know, I'm going to be watching the dynamic between the president and the new Democratic majority in Congress, because I feel like right now there's a major incentive, a political incentive for a showdown. And so I think from the president, we're going to see him digging his heels in and really, you know, showing his base that he's serious about getting his wall done. But I think on the left, we see Democrats who really don't have much of an incentive to capitulate there. I mean, I think they really want to come off as the people and as the adults in the room in advance, like Kerry said, of that 2020 election. And so, you know, I think the big question for me is whether the agenda of our federal lawmakers will match the American people's agenda.
Well, Michael Bitzer, I'll ask you to answer the question, the big question, what you're looking at, because that's what I put to everybody. But respond to what Deandra just said, which is this notion that both sides have it in their best interest to really take a hard line. Who wins in a showdown like that, do you think?
I would agree with everything that all my colleagues have said. I think the issue for me going into 2019 and particularly 2020 is exactly that. Do we have some kind of pragmatic sense of governance by which not only at the federal level but also in the state of North Carolina with divided government, do we accomplish anything in terms of getting some public policy issues addressed, or does public policy become weaponized for the 2020 campaign? It's going to be intense. It's going to be, you know, if 2018 was any indication, we are going to see bitter partisanship in terms of the campaigns on both sides. And I think, you know, what both political parties are going to try and do is make a stand for their respective bases. But the willingness to compromise and get anything done will, I think, be the real test of what the next 2 years will hold for, both in D.C. and in Raleigh.
Susan Roberts, how important is that? How important is actually getting things done when politics really has devolved into this kind of the sort of name-calling and polarization, and it's about ideology and less about what's actually being done on the ground? I mean, does accomplishing anything really get you points in Washington, do you think, with voters?
Well, yeah. I might add, too, when we talk about polarization, we used to talk about polarization within the elites, the office holders, and now it's extended down to the voters themselves and to people in which they see members of the other party as a threat to the nation. And that we have to overcome, too. If we see anything in terms of working together, I think it'll be a little bit more like cherry picking. They'll get a few Democrats or a few Republicans to go along. It is important that we've replaced, I think, the policy with the political. And when it's a showdown, when it's a game of political chicken, those are high stakes. And I think that's what we see going on right now. And as Michael said, we would hope to have some pragmatism and cooler heads prevail. And maybe, as Carrie said, maybe the women in office who have been looked at in many respects as the adults in the room and the people that are viewed as more trustworthy and more willing to compromise, that might be something that we could see in 2019, 2020.
Well, Carrie Haney, I wonder if that kind of diversity, particularly with more women in office today, both at the state level and states around the country and at the federal level, if that has as much to do with change in policy or mobilization, the idea that the momentum that began up to the midterm elections carries through to 2020.
I think this issue of mobilization is correct, and I think paying attention to what happens on the ground outside of the halls of government, but on the ground with the electorate. This was a different electorate in 2018 that led to what we now see in the U.S. Congress and in various state legislatures, an activist electorate, which will demand, I think, some attention and some action and not politics as usual. So I think the incumbents in Congress will be watching the voters on the street to see what happens. And it's in their interest to get something done and to work across the aisles on some issues. If it's something like infrastructure, where everyone seems to agree that there's a need in the country, you may see some action in an area like that so they can say, hey, we got something done.
Yeah, although then it's a good question of who gets credit for that. So everybody's cautious about whether the president's going to get credit or Congress. So, Deanna, let's talk a little bit more about this activism, because on the one hand, we're putting people in Congress who we haven't seen before, mm-hmm. who have in some cases run unconventional campaigns and mm-hmm. overthrew party elites to get even the nomination. But now they're in power. And
yes.
So they're going to have to appeal to their constituents in a way that was different than they did as outsiders. I mean, what is that mm-hmm. going to do for the whole movement, do you think?
I mean, I think it's just one indicator of the fact that we're in an entirely new place politically. So there was this interesting example. Recently, there was a tweet that released a video of now New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was dancing on a rooftop, you know, basically in a breakfast, the breakfast club in the style mm-hmm. of this like Ali Sheedy montage. And it was intended to basically humiliate her, but it turned out that her base loved it. You know, people were tweeting about how much they enjoyed watching this, and they hoped that other representatives were as fun. I think that right now we're seeing a wave of new energy and new expectations for our lawmakers.
So Susan Roberts, maybe the question, first of all, you can respond directly to that, but then I'd have a question about whether or not the institution then changes the outsider or the outsider can change the institution. Susan?
Sure. I think for decades, however, members of Congress have run for Congress by running against Congress. And so running to change things is decades old. I do believe that when we look at the younger versus the more seasoned, the Brookings Institute had a very important factoid that only 41% of the newly elected members of the House have had any political experience. Mm-hmm. That's good and it's bad. I mean, as someone says, you have to know where the bathrooms are to be really effective. It takes you a few weeks, but I think there is encouraging. As Deandra said about the video, you know, you have to be authentic. I think authenticity is something that voters look for. And I have my doubts about whether or not Elizabeth Warren looking into posting on Instagram about getting herself a beer is something that voters see as authentic for her. That's not her image, and I think she's trying to soften her image, but it didn't work so well with Hillary Clinton. I think we're right in terms of there has to be new energy and new ideas, and people are frustrated with politicians, with Congress, the president, the direction of the country, and so something does need to change.
Frank, let me jump in here and make this point. You know, with this new energy that we're talking about and we recognize and we see, when the Congress was called into session yesterday and then the leadership appeared, it was a night and day difference, right? You see Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and Congressman Clyburn in their late 70s, right? And this young generation, yeah. So the leadership doesn't reflect what we actually see, this new energy. That's going to be a balance that the Democrats will have to work out, move it into 2020 if they want that electorate that brought this new energy to Congress to stay with them in the 2020 presidential election. You've got to work this out somehow.
Well, let me, Michael Bitzer, let you take the 30-second version of that, how they work that out. We'll come back and talk more about it. But that is a big divide in the Democratic Party, right?
I think that's a huge divide, and it reflects the country as a whole. The demographic shift, millennials in 2020 will be under the age of 40. And I think this coming election cycle is indeed going to be a dramatic shift in how the country deals with it electorally, politically, public policy-wise. There's going to be a dramatic change come in 2020, and I think the country is on the cusp of that kind of shift going on.
Talk about what that might look like with Michael Bitzer, a professor of politics and history at Catawba College, Carrie Haney, a professor of political science and African-American studies at Duke, Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson College, and Deandra Rose, a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Our look into the crystal ball for the year 2019 continues on The State of Things after this. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The 2020 presidential election is looming large, even though we've just started 2019. Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts denounced her presidential campaign on New Year's Eve. New Year's Day, Republican Senator Mitt Romney from Utah released an op-ed critical of Donald Trump. Some pundits are saying that's a signal he's planning to challenge the president in 2020. We're exploring these issues and more with our panel of political experts. Carrie Haney, a professor of political science and African-American studies at Duke. Michael Bitzer is a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Deandra Rose is with us, a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. And Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson College. Michael Bitzer, I want to go back to you to follow up a little bit on what you were saying on these kind of the big changes in the works. I mean, a lot of it depends on whether the Democratic Party leadership is going to get out of the way of a grassroots movement that seems to be signaling something and has been, one could argue, since 2008, trying to signal change in the wind, or whether, you know, it's the institution, you know, dominates and puts the brakes on this. How do you think it's going to play out?
I think it's going to play out most notably in the presidential nominating process. We are expecting a bus full of Democrats to, you know, explore, to consider, to announce their intention to run for the presidency. And it almost feels like to me that this is going to be part of the sign of a generational shift going on, not just within the Democratic Party, but within the electorate as a whole. Because if you look at millennials, they tend to be a center-left oriented kind of generation, as opposed to baby boomers and Gen Xers that tend to be more center-right. So the question in my mind going into 2020 is, are we seeing the start of the demise of the Reagan coalition that has basically run the country through baby boomers for the past 40-some-odd years, and will we start to see a shift with the pendulum swinging and a new kind of Democratic Party aligned around perhaps a progressive, pragmatic approach that could signal a whole new cycle for presidential social politics. I think we are in the cusp of a kind of shift going on, and historically this may be the sign that we're starting to see these things evolve.
Yeah, and you pointed that out, that this is kind of a cyclical shift, that this could be a swing back to the FDR kind of center-left coalition, although, albeit a more inclusive coalition than we would have seen back in the 30s and 40s. So,
right.
Carrie Haney, what are you thinking about? Let's talk about this Democratic field as it shapes up. It's a very large one, as we might expect.
Yes, it's going to be interesting, Frank. I mean, with this this point Susan made earlier with this shift, right, you have these new folks coming in and new people on the scene who tend to lack experience, right? So here's the rub, right? So how do you involve them and include them as part of the leadership and the structure lacking what may be the records with experience? Now, I say that, and I think back to Barack Obama, who came in a similar fashion as some of the newly elected members of Congress and became president. But this is going to be the trick to make sure that you can integrate these people in a way that the base in the electorate sees that that energy has not been lost and for naught.
Right. And to the extent that the institution is malleable enough to accept the change.
Accept the change.
I mean, the thing that Barack Obama did was run an entirely different campaign that the Democratic Party would never have been able to engineer.
That's right.
And that's what allowed that historic win. And so when it was business as usual in 2016...
We lost.
would a Democrat say? Deandra, let's talk a little bit about the Democratic field and how you see it shaping up and what it means. Because obviously there's going to be a lot of diversity. Joe Biden is, you know, clearly, I mean, he represents the old guard. Dianne Feinstein said she supports him already.
Wow.
This is 2019. And so the fact that she made the endorsement or said that she would if he would run tells you that there's a lot of pressure on the old guard to stay in power. So how do you see things shaping
absolutely
up?
Absolutely. And I should say, speaking of the old guard, Dianne Feinstein is the most senior member of the Senate right now at 85. I think, you know, this is a major window of opportunity for the Democratic Party. It's the first time in about 15 years that there's been no clear front runner for the party's nomination, you know, no establishment candidate. So I think we're going to see everyone and his or her mother jump into this race. So, I mean, of course, we see Elizabeth Warren, you know, getting things started, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders. I could imagine Stacey Abrams getting in on the action now that she has some national attention following the gubernatorial race in Georgia. But I think that I've read somewhere that approximately 30 Democrats are mulling over jumping in.
Including Kamala Harris and Kirsten Gillibrand in New York. So a lot of women's names are up in ways that we had not heard as serious contenders. Mm-hmm. Susan Roberts, how do you see this shaping up and what does it mean for the Democratic Party? I mean, obviously they've had Donnybrooks like this before and they've survived them.
Sure. The one question, very succinct, I think it's going to come down to a question of ideology versus electability. And I think Democrats have to look long and hard as to whether or not they want to send Trump packing or whether or not they want to put forth an ideology that might represent a progressive direction that much of the electorate and the millennials, as Michael said, are headed in. And I think that it is going to be the case that almost like as if, you know, the vote on Kavanaugh, are you pragmatic? Are you principled? And I think ideology and electability would be the key words for me.
Susan, let me stick with you for 1 minute, and then I'll put this question to everybody, and that is whether or not, you know, the idea, Michael Bitzer said millennials tend to be a kind of center-left group in general as they poll. But do they vote? And I mean, the question, and it's not about apathy. It's about whether or not this system represents a sensible system to anybody who rationally and objectively looks at the way we do politics in America. One could make the rational decision that this is not a functioning system and therefore look for other means. Are people becoming disengaged? Is the polarization in politics turning off younger voters? Susan, I'll stick with you, and then we'll kind of go around the table.
Sure. I mean, if I were a campaign strategist, I would advise my candidate to say, look, I mean, for as long as we can remember, the young vote is the cohort that votes the least. But I also think that they're becoming more engaged. You used to say that older voters had more of a stake in politics, paying taxes, et cetera. Well, younger voters have a stake, too. It's just very different. And they're taking, I think, that kind of commitment to community service and say, how can we change things? And I think also if we look at some of the issues in terms of progressive causes and wanting to change the system, there may be more idealism and optimism than there ever has been before. So I think that younger voters are not necessarily, we didn't call them millennials, but people tend to say, can we cater a message that will get to the people that A, do vote, B, are not partisan, but can we siphon off some independents? So it's a very complex strategy for anyone thinking of running for any office.
Michael Bitzer, as you look at the data, that the kind of numbers that you crunch, what would those issues be and what would the message be that would reach a group of voters who see things very differently and who understand our institutions very differently?
Yeah, I completely agree with what Susan said. I think what younger voters nowadays, and particularly those under the age of 40 by 2020, are looking for is a kind of pragmatic government involvement, recognizing that government can't do everything, but that government can be used for public policy issues to attack some issues and concerns that they have. Environmentalism certainly is a key issue. Equality of rights for all citizens is certainly another one that I think speaks volumes for this particular generation and those coming of age. And so I think even though they may be eschewing the labels, they are very much political in terms of their behavior, and they want government to join with private organizations, non-governmental organizations, a whole host of folks to attack issues that confront society as a whole.
Let's talk about the on the Republican side, Kerry Haney. There could be a fight for the nomination there as well. What do Republicans have to do? Because, again, they're facing some fairly big challenges, like the Democrats in the 2018 election, where most of the 33 senators were Democrats defending their seats. The Republicans are in that position now, and some of them are in states that Hillary Clinton took.
Yes, so the Republicans have quite the challenge. This demographic shift that we've been discussing is one that they'll face in 2020 and beyond if they don't figure out a way to reach out to some of these millennial and African-American, Latino voters and bring them into the Republican fold. Also, Mr. Trump is a problem for the Republican Party going forward. Trump has defined the party in a way that's not been the traditional Republican Party. Going into the 2020 election, he's likely to get a challenge. I think Mitt Romney opened up that possibility with his op-ed this week and gave at least a roadmap towards a challenge, to challenge Mr. Trump on morality and just being a decent person in politics as opposed to policy differences. And that may be yet a way we see a challenge in the Republican Party.
DeAndre, let me talk to you because I know you're a public policy expert, and obviously Donald Trump's public policy pronouncements are what won him the election, and he's going to move forward with that, and how successful he is in actually getting what he wants is one question, but he'll be clear about, you know, kind of what he stands for. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that this hurts the Republicans, that his position on these public policy issues that won him the White House, you know, we'll keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Cheer them on.
I think as we see more Americans identify as independents and we see more people who are sort of embracing the center of our political spectrum, both parties and their leaders will have to work to win them over. And I think that President Trump does a great job of appealing to the far right. But I think that, you know, there are a number of more moderate Republicans who could do a better job of peeling off those independents and, the people who are closer to the center. And so people like John Kasich and Jeff Flake have actually been in New Hampshire already. And so I could imagine them and former Senator Flake has actually said that he thinks that Donald Trump should stand down in 2020. So I think we could really see some challenges that are interesting.
And in terms of just the politics in Washington and getting legislation passed, I mean, we've already seen two Republicans Republican senators in those states who are running for re-election in states that Hillary Clinton took, Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado and Susan Collins of Maine, say already that they are calling for an end to the government shutdown. So, Susan Roberts, this would give some hope, it would seem to me, to Nancy Pelosi for possibly getting some legislation all the way through.
I think you're correct. I think the shutdown, the third one that we've had in 2018, but one lasted for 2 or 3 hours, I think that the shutdown is both a visual, as I said before, and a verbal. When you see the pictures of overflowing trash cans, you see the signs that say park closed, and you hear the narratives of the individuals who have lost their jobs, especially as this hit. It's almost a perfect storm for Nancy Pelosi. Everything's coming together. It was the holiday season. People understand being strapped for money. They look and say, these people aren't getting a paycheck or they're working without pay. I think Nancy Pelosi does have a chance. And I think Mitch McConnell has to decide for himself, to what extent am I afraid of the president or I do something that most people will agree on. One thing playing off what Deandra said that I think is very important is that some of the policies aren't the visible ones. What Trump has been able to do with regulatory policy in education, in the environment, and all of these are things that are under the radar of most people. And I think Trump probably likes it that way.
Well, but, you know, they are and they aren't. I mean, let's get back to education, for instance,
yeah.
Susan. When we talk about the fact that teachers are organizing all over, including, I mean, back
sure.
in Wisconsin, so and certainly here in North Carolina. So, again, they may be under the radar, but they're not totally unnoticed.
Well, some of them, and I can't go into detail, but some of them having to do with sexual harassment policies on college campuses are ones that people aren't talking about. But clearly, teachers in North Carolina and all over the country, Wisconsin state workers are saying, we have the power of protest. And that used to be, protest used to be a little passe. It was more the era of checkbook activism. You just wrote a check to your interest groups and figured that someone would lobby for you. And now people are saying, I don't really need the lobbyist. I need to have, you know, boots on the ground. I need to go out there. One thing I wanted to mention when we were talking about the youth voter is not to underestimate what happened in Parkland, and that's going to be, that gives young voters a stake that doesn't have to be something that deals with an issue that they don't touch. It affects their lives. This is a generation, and I always think of it when I look at my students, that has grown up with terrorism, has grown up with gun violence, and I think that might be something that animates millennials and Generation X, Z going down the line.
Well, and Michael Bitzer, the other thing that turns off voters and keeps them away from the polls is the sense that their vote doesn't count. But I wonder if there's anything about the midterm elections, the 2018 elections, that could convince people otherwise, that actually are active, that being fed up is and getting out there and vote actually might make a difference.
I hate to say it, but the 9th Congressional District immediately comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
905 votes unofficially, but then you have issues of how were some ballots dealt with in, say, Bladen County, Robeson, Columbus County. I think, you know, the continuation, and we saw this in Georgia as well with charges of voter suppression. I think, you know, this activism, particularly by younger citizens in our country, is something that is going to be captured in one of the two political parties. Right now, I would have to say the Democrats are the most likely to capture that kind of energy and enthusiasm and really drive 2020 in terms of who will be the plurality of voters showing up. It most likely will be those under the age of 40. So we have to be thinking about this tectonic shift going on in terms of who's showing up, who's participating. As Susan noted, it's not just casting ballots. It's also protest. It's also engagement. It's running for political office that we saw in 2018. I think all of these dynamics are really building a wave that is going to be fascinating for those of us who watch this, my colleagues and myself, to see how this all plays out in the next 2 years.
Kerry Haney, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things I was going to say, Frank, along with this is the races that Michael mentioned in Georgia, at Florida, at Texas, Beto O'Rourke. The closeness of those elections said to voters and potential voters, maybe my vote might matter. Because we've seen, and now it's election after election, where there have been close votes. And candidates, particularly the younger generation, have been able to say, look, your vote does matter. 905 votes separating in the 9th district. That's a message that may play well.
Well, let's talk about what this might mean for Susan Roberts. Let me ask you what this might mean here in North Carolina. This is a state that's really been under the microscope when it's come to voter suppression, the voting of voter ID bills, and also redistricting, again, kind of racial gerrymandering that the North Carolina legislature has been flagged for. What do we expect now in North Carolina politics with a divided legislature?
Well, I think that ending the veto-proof supermajority is one thing, but it's not everything. And I think that the Republicans have been able to do all they've been able to do in terms of voting rights, in terms of other social issues. It's kind of because we can. And I think that, as Michael points out, if your vote counts, if you want your vote to count and you feel as if it's going to count, you also have to say, am I in a gerrymandered district? Redistricting and gerrymandered have become synonymous. But one thing I think is important, as a political scientist, I've really cheered this on, is that gerrymandering is now something that most people in the country have heard of and will consider when they're thinking about politics in general. They don't think campaign finance is necessarily the worst thing out there. They think gerrymandering is, and they want their vote to count. And I think North Carolina is going to face another confusing round because I don't have the numbers, but it's anticipated that North Carolina will get a seat after 2020 census. Then you've got to, then the map has to be redrawn. And what are the dynamics that go into that?
DeAndre Rose, I've given you just 30 seconds.
So I guess one thing I should point out is just the significance of technology in public policy and political science and politics right now. So technology makes it easier than ever to draw, you know, particularly biased or leaning congressional districts. But it should also make it really easy to draw fair districts. And so I think, again, especially among young voters and people who are paying attention, I think we expect more from our lawmakers and political institutions. And so however we handle this, people are going to be watching.
I want to thank all of you today. DeAndre Rose, a professor of public policy and political science at Duke. Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College. Carrie Haney, a professor of political science and African-American studies at Duke University. Michael Bitzer, a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Thank you all and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Just ahead, the music of Chatham Rabbits. Stay tuned.